Chapter 2, The Search into Beginnings. It is natural that man should concern himself with beginnings. This is a part of the curiosity of the mind. Without it, there would be no exploration of the world, and there would be no growth. The twin queries that haunt the mind are why and how. Perhaps the order is most often reversed, how and then why. This is an inherent characteristic of mind. It is not unique to any particular age of man, culture, or society. Contemplation concerning origins is a part of the curiosity of the race. Such contemplation may arise out of the need to have experience make sense, to make it fit into some kind of order in the simplest and most elementary manner, or it may express itself out of a kind of sophistication as man seeks to relate to his world meaningfully in an effort to manipulate it to private ends, to control it, or master it in establishing his own emotional security. But whatever may be the reason, the essential characteristic behavior persists as we want to know how the world began, where we came from, and what the meaning of life and life is. When we examine the various accounts of how the world began, the origin of life in general, and man's work in particular, we are face to face with what has been aptly called the memory of a lost harmony. One notices immediately that ideas about the origin of man are completely separated from whatever is thought of as the origin of life. The origin of life is never separated from the origin of the world. This is a most intriguing realization. It is as if the sense of common origin is inescapable. Brooding over the bill of particulars of creation, there is the notion of an active continuum or spirit or vital complex that is being demonstrated. Always, the manifestation is an expression of an internal order. What emerges out of the brooding formlessness called chaos is order. Any part of nature, say a rock, a tree, or a man, is an expression of order. The relation between a rock, a tree, and a man is also an expression of order. Where the mind cannot see order, it sees chaos. Chaos is always giving way to order as knowledge and insight develop. The total impact of this concept was brought home for me many years ago. When I was a small boy growing up in Daytona Beach, Florida, I earned money doing various chores. One of my regular chores was to collect discarded newspapers and magazines from certain homes and take them for disposal to the city dump. Once each month, there was included one magazine called the Atlantic Monthly. It was printed on heavy enamel paper that made it very hard to burn. But this is not the thing that stands out in my memory most dramatically. No. What remains in my mind most clearly is a full-page advertisement of a Hamilton watch. In the center of the page was a reproduction of Rodin's Thinker. This picture affected me profoundly. In fact, I was so enamored of it that I tried to reproduce the pose, the stance, the furrowed brow, the chin resting on the flat side of the fist. These became, for me, hallmarks of thought and profundity. I practiced the pose whenever I had a spare moment and something to lean against. One day, I recall my mother told my sister to call me to do an errand. I was leaning against the fence, perfecting my stance. I told her to tell my mother that I was thinking. Needless to say, I did not repeat that again. Years later, I visited the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York City. In the Rodin Gallery, I saw a reproduction of The Thinker. As I walked away from the figure, my hands behind me, my head bowed, my mind buried in thought, I suddenly found my way blocked by the base of a pedestal. When I looked up, I was standing in the presence of the back view of Rodin's Hand of God. Here was the back of the great hand, the long, graceful fingers, three in full view, supported by the giant thumb. Slowly, I made my way around to the front of the hand, and what I saw there transfixed me in my place, the giant hand, and always the mighty thumb. Yet deep in the palm of the hand, the chaotic stuff of life. In fact, the hand itself seemed to emerge out of a kind of chaotic conglomerate. And yet from within the hand, coming up out of this stuff of life, were the shapely bodies of human beings. It was as if a dream of order, implicit in chaos itself, and yet brooding over chaos, were being held in terrible tension over the stuff of life, until the stuff of life began to respond in shape and form, which was but a manifestation of its own potential. Such was the concept of the artist as it realized itself in his medium. In his creation, he says to mankind, "This is how we came to be. This is my interpretation of the racial memory of a lost harmony." In the search for truth on the part of astronomers, physicists, geologists, biologists, and other scientists, a wide variety of hypotheses and theories have developed and will continue to develop in all the years that life remains intact on our planet. As Lauren C. Isley reminds us in the article in Harper's Magazine of October 1953, after having chided the theologist for his reliance on myth and miracle, science found itself in the inevitable position of having to create a mythology of its own, namely the assumption that what, after long effort, could not be proved to take place today had, in truth, taken place in the primeval past. In Maria Leach's The Beginning, Creation Myths Around the World, the first chapter neatly summarizes the ways in which the scientific mind has dealt with the question of beginnings. The opening paragraph reads, "The Old Farmer's Almanac says that the world began at 9 o'clock in the morning on Wednesday, October 26th, in the year 4004 BC. This is a famous date worked out by James Usher, Archbishop of Armagh in Ireland, from his studies of Hebrew chronology. It is understandable that man would regard his earth as the center of all creation. Given this fact, it is but a step in logic to arrive at a position of human supremacy over all creation. Out of this position, man may conclude that his place in space is the center of all existence or existences. Even the thought that there might be other inhabitants in the world and systems beyond our own must have been extremely threatening to the egos of those who first considered such a possibility." A simple listing of some of the important scientific theories or accounts of the beginning of the world, as outlined in Maria Leach's first chapter, reads as follows. 1, the nebular hypotheses. 2, the eruption of planetesimal theory. 3, the tidal theory. 4, the collision theory. 5, the catastrophic theory, or the story of the big blow-up. 6, the tale of the lonely atoms, or the continuous creation theory. Each of these is an attempt to answer how. Through this process, the mind seeks to push back the veil of mystery that shrouds the concept of origin. The mind lives under the duress of strange and wonderful urgency in this regard. The important thing about such activity is that even though the boundaries or beginnings of existence cannot be definitely established, science has succeeded in pushing them back beyond what at one time were assented limits. And this has added enormously to the scope of the meaning of man's life and the world in which the life finds a crucial part of its meaning. Here, a comment from J.H. Rush's stimulating and creative book, The Dawn of Life, seems relevant. What this groping in the past has given us is nothing less than a radically new way of thinking about the universe and our place in it. To my mind, this new approach is the most fundamental of all changes that science has brought to our lives and thoughts, the most far-reaching in its implications for our understanding of nature and ourselves. It is the principle of evolution. Since then, according to Dr. Rush's, life finds it reassuring for its purposes not to think of a beginning, or better, the beginning, but rather to think of beginning, a vast series of creative pushes, each one after the manner of its own idiom or genius, as it were. Of course, such theorizing does not preclude the notion of a boundless extension of a vibrant continuum from which moves an unnumbered series of beginnings, always with the possibility that a beginning may beget a beginning ad infinitum. What is relevant here is that there is an implicit in all those probable developments an inherent order, harmony, integration. This is not as formal acts of consciousness, but rather as the pattern or characteristic of the way the creations are formed. It is not necessary to say that it is the way the creations are fashioned. The scientific theories leave out any elements that would indicate a notion of intrinsic purpose or design. They seem to want to deal with the matter of beginnings without introducing the idea of a creator or the utterly religious term God. As such, notions are expressed, if at all, by implication. This is as it should be. This is as it should be. For science is but one of the moods of the human spirit. It does not imply that the other moods are fallacious or futile. It does not hold that the truth it enables men to discover are the only truths. In the creation accounts that have grown or developed out of the seedbed of culture and the spiritual and religious aspiration of the race, something is in evidence that is outside the range of perspective of science. An attempt is made to account for more than the external world of nature or the elements that make up the natural environments of man. Nothing less than facing the issue of why is worthy of being transmitted from generation to generation in myriad forms among all the children of men wherever they are found. Here we come upon the creation myths. Here we get fleeting and sometimes sustained views of the Creator at work, fashioning the world and bringing into consciousness a thing called life and the living experience. It is in many of these accounts that the concept of intent appears. In practically every recorded instance, the Creator, or in some instances, the Creators, has something in mind that he seeks to bring to pass in the act of creation. This does not become apparent until, in the sequence of creation, man appears. At that moment, the organic harmony in the interrelatedness of all creation becomes a part of the quality of life itself, a part of the experienced intent of all living things. And it reaches its most impressive articulation in the behavior of human beings. When life appears, it is already committed to realizing itself by the kind of inner harmony and integration that is the way life reproduces itself and persists. The fullness of time is a suggestive phrase, meaning the experience of a community within an organism when its issue comes forth and makes a bid for the continuity of the form. I shall now examine two remarkable creation accounts, the first as found in the Judeo-Christian religious tradition, the second as expressed in the creation myth of the Hopi Indians. Let me caution the reader that I have no desire to do violence to any man's particular religious faith. I am simply putting the story of Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden, as found in the book of Genesis, in the perspective of the creation account as it's occurred throughout human history. In this sense, the Genesis story is a creation myth, one of many. In explaining my use of the term myth, I cannot do better than give the definition as found in Webster's New Intercollegiate Dictionary, which is sufficiently simple so as to avoid any detailed excursion into anthropology. A myth is a story, the origin of which is forgotten, ostensibly historical, but usually such as to explain some practice, belief, institution, or natural phenomenon. The myth, therefore, undertakes to answer a real question about currently experienced, continuous events in the common life. In the creation myth, which is a part of our religious heritage, the question that it tries to answer is universal. How did the world get started? How did it come into being in the first instance? How was man born originally when there were no parents? How did man, in all his difficulties, start to evolve? The author or the authors of Genesis tell the following story. On the sixth day of creation, after God created light and made time and space, matter in all its forms, organic and inorganic, God said, "Let the earth bring forth the living creatures after his kind, cattle and creeping things and beasts of the earth after his kind." And it was so. And God saw that it was good. Then God said, "Let us make man in our image, after our likeness, and let him have dominion over the fish of the sea, and over the fowl of the air, and over the cattle, and over all the earth, and over every creeping thing that creepeth upon the earth." So God created man in his own image. Male and female created he them. And the Lord God took the man and put him into the Garden of Eden to dress it and to keep it. And the Lord God commanded the man, saying, "Of every tree of the garden thou mayest freely eat, but the tree of the knowledge of good and evil thou shalt not eat of it. For in the day that thou eatest thereof thou shalt surely die." The account continues with the idyllic picture of harmony, of community, of tranquility. So influential has the symbolism of the Garden of Eden become in our heritage that when we wish to describe something utterly beautiful and truthful, we say that it is like the Garden of Eden. And by this we mean quite concretely that here is community, wholeness, harmony, with no invasion of the divisiveness out of which discord, disharmony, dissent arise. But it is the harmony of innocence, a harmony that is given as a part of the givenness of the Creator to his creation. But the author is not through, he says. "The serpent said unto the woman, Hath God said, Ye shall not eat of every tree in the garden? And the woman said unto the serpent, We may eat of the fruit of the trees of the garden, but of the fruit of the tree which is in the midst of the garden, God has said, Ye shall not eat of it, neither shall ye taste it, lest ye die. And the serpent said," to paraphrase, "How stupid can you be? Don't you know why God told you this? He knows that if you eat the fruit of the tree, you will become just as he is. And then you will be autonomous. He will not be able to control you." So the woman was convinced and tried to convince Adam and thus make her action binding for him as well. Adam ate the fruit of the tree of knowledge of good and evil, shattering the community of innocence, strife, discord, enmity, disharmony, suffering, violence, all of these flowed. And they were construed as being at variance with the intent of the Creator in the creation or making of life. In this creation account, Adam is innocent, but he has the potential of behavior that will destroy his innocence. He also has the potential of harmony, and this is a part of the dialectical dimension of his nature. This former potential is epitomized in Eve, who is a part of Adam. Thus, Adam has the potential for harmony and its maintenance, as well as the potential for the disruption of harmony. When the potential for disharmony is actualized in Adam by his volitional act, contrary to the Creator's intent, he loses his sense of community with the rest of creation. He loses his innocence, and in the loss of his innocence, for the first time, he becomes a responsible creature, responsible to the Creator. For it is the Creator's intent in creating him that he has violated. Now he is also responsible to himself for his actions. Or it may be said that in Adam's innocence is given, the state of innocence that is given makes it clear that Adam is as if he were fresh born, as according to the account he is. This potential is actualized without achievement or struggle. He experiences a view of what his life ought to be and in fact is, but when he violates the intent of the Creator inherent in him, he separates himself from that existence. He is forced now to win it, to achieve it by its own struggle. As long as the potential is a fact given in his creation, Adam is an active participant in the community along with the creation. There is no responsibility for action so long as he functions out of innocence. In the creation myth of the Hopi Indians, the name given to the first world created by the Creator Taiwa and Tokapela, or endless space. Before the existence of this first world, there was only the Creator. All else was endless space. There was no beginning and no end, no time, no shape, no life. Time and form and shape, all substance, existed only in the mind of the Creator. His first act was to conceive the finite, the bounded, the limited. All thisness and thatness came into being by his projection. Hence the finite was first a concept. In order to make the finite manifest itself or establish an existence in its own authenticity or right, he created as his first act Sotunang, saying to him, I have created you, the first power and instrument as a person, to carry out my plan for life in endless space. I am your uncle. You are my nephew. Go now and lay out these universes in proper order so that they may work harmoniously with one another according to my plan. So Tunang went to work to accomplish what the Creator intended. He brought solid substance out of the endless space and gave to it shape and form and established it as 9 universal kingdoms, divided as follows, 1 each for the Creator and himself and 7 others for the life that was yet to come. Taiwa was pleased. Then he ordered Satunang to accomplish the same ends with waters, which he placed on the surfaces of the universes in an equal manner. The waters were divided equally among the universes, half solid and half water. Next, the nephew was directed to create forces of air to surround the waters with peaceful movement. Each universe had great forces of air arranged into gentle order and rhythm around each universe. Taiwa was pleased. He then ordered his nephew to create life and its movement to round out the 4 parts of a universal plan. After this, Sotunang went to Tokapela, the first world, and there he created woman to be his helper. He named her Kokyong Wuti, Spider Woman. As soon as she came to life, she queried, why am I here? Always the persistent question of the human spirit. The nephew said, look about you. Here is the earth we have created. It has shape and substance, direction and time, a beginning and an end. but there is no life upon it. We see no joyful movement. We hear no joyful sounds. What is life without sound or movement? So you have been given the power to help us create this life. You have been given the knowledge, wisdom, and love to bless all the beings you create. This is why you are here. She has been created to create. The Spider Woman obeyed. She mixed earth with her saliva and molded it into two twin beings. She proceeded to cover them with a white cape of creative wisdom and sang the creation song over them. As soon as she uncovered them, the twins sat up and asked the same question. Who are we? Why are we here? Then the Spider Woman said to the one on the right, you are Po Quang Hoya, and you are here to help keep this world in order when life is put upon it. Go now around all the world and put your hands upon the earth so that it will become fully solidified. This is your duty. Order had to be grounded as integral in the earth. To the twin on the left, she said, you are Palung Hoya, and you are to help keep this world in order when life is put upon it. This is your duty now. Go about all the world and send out sound so that it may be heard throughout the land. When this is heard, you will be known as Echo, for all sounds echoes the Creator. The twins obeyed. Mountains and valleys were fashioned as the earth was formed by the hand of Po Quang Hoya, while Palung Hoya sounded his call, and all the vibratory centers along the earth's axis resounded. The whole earth trembled. The universe quivered in tune. The whole world became attuned, resounding the praise of the Creator. When their special work was completed, they were sent, one to the South Pole and the other to the North Pole, to keep the earth rotating in an established harmony of rhythm. One was instructed to keep the earth solid and firm, while the other was assigned to keep the air in gentle motion and to send out his call for good or for warning. These duties looked toward the future because creation had not yet fully been accomplished. Now the Spider Woman sent about the creation of the world of nature, trees, plants, bushes, each with his own name and order of life. Then followed birds of all kinds and animals, each one in its own line of life, with its own peculiar or special name. She covered each with the substance of her white mantled cape, which they would share in the wisdom of the Creator. Some she placed to her right, some to her left, others before and behind her, indicating how they should spread to all four corners of the earth to live. When Taiwa saw what she has done, he was well pleased and said, it is ready now for human life, the final touch to complete my plan. At this point, we may observe that the intent of the Creator in readying the world for man was to establish order and harmony. These were built into the very fabric of creation. One is reminded of an experience of Admiral Byrd at the South Pole when he was alone, quite removed from the camp base. He stood outside his hut and seemed to hear the harmony of creation in the vast quiet of the Antarctic twilight. The day was dying, the night being born, but with great peace. Here were the imponderable processes and forces of the cosmos, harmonious and soundless. Harmony, that was it. That was what came out of the silence. A gentle rhythm, the strain of a perfect chord, the music of the spheres, perhaps. It was enough to catch the rhythm momentarily to be myself, a part of it. In that instant, I could feel no doubt of man's oneness with the universe. The conviction came that that rhythm was too orderly, too harmonious, too perfect to be a product of blind chance. that, therefore, there must be purpose in the whole, and that man was part of that whole, and not an accidental offshoot. It was a feeling that transcended reason, that went to the heart of man's despair and found it groundless. The universe was a cosmos, not a chaos. Man was as rightfully a part of that cosmos as were the day and night. In this, the prelude to what the poet saw when he says, referring to man, "Grand as the rest may be, he ruins it? We shall see." In the creation of mankind, Spider-Woman followed the same general procedure as before, except that she chose four colors of earth: yellow, red, white, and black. She mixed the earth with saliva, molded it into shapes, then covered them with the white substance of her cape, creative wisdom itself. The first four men were made in the image of Sotunong, after which she created four other human beings in her image to be their partners. When they were all uncovered, they came to life, but not until the mantle of creative wisdom had done its work in them. When the mantle was lifted, they were alive. This was the time of the dark purple light, the first phase of the dawn of creation, which first reveals the mystery of man's creation. When they first awoke and began to move, their foreheads were damp, and a soft spot was in the crown of their heads. This marked the second phase of the creation of man, the time of the yellow light, for it was now that the breath of life entered man. Then the sun appeared to dry them off and to harden the soft spot in the heads. This to mark the time of the yellow light as the third phase of the dawn of creation. Man, now fully formed, was ready to face his creator, fashioned in his image. The Spider Woman said to them, "That is the sun. You are meeting your father and the creator for the first time. You must always remember and observe the three phases of your creation, the time of the three lights. The dark purple, the yellow, and the red reveal in turn the mystery, the breath of life, and the warmth of love. These comprise the Creator's plan of life for you as sung over you in the song of creation. This was the time of the red light." Because they had not been given the power of speech, the first people of the first world could not answer her. So Sotunong was summoned. The Spider Woman said to him, "As you commanded me, I have created these first people. They are fully and firmly formed. They are properly colored. They have life. They have movement, but they cannot talk. So I want you to give them speech. Also, the wisdom and the power to reproduce, so that they may enjoy their life and give thanks to the Creator." It was done. A different language was given to each color. They were given the wisdom and the power to reproduce and multiply. Then Sotunong said to them, "With all of these, I have given you this world to live on and to be happy. There is only one thing I ask of you, to respect the Creator at all times. Wisdom, harmony, community, and the respect for the love of the Creator who made you. May it grow and never be forgotten among you as long as you live." In their happiness, the first people began to multiply. The nature of man, as conceived in the Hopi creation myth, clearly illustrates my basic thesis concerning order, harmony, and actualized potential as reflected in the racial memory of a forgotten harmony. As a result of the work of the mantle of wisdom, which was central to process of creation, man knew that the earth was a living entity like himself. The earth itself was alive and living. The Creator breathed through the earth. Such is the experience of many persons, even in our time, who live close to the earth. It seems to be alive, not merely vital, but alive. The Hopi idea was that those created in the first world knew that they were made from the flesh of the earth and were nourished at her breast. The grass upon which all animals fed was the milk of her body. To them, the corn plant was also a living entity with a body very much like their own. It was a simple step to make. Earth mother, corn mother. They knew their father also in two dimensions. First, as we have seen, they knew him as the sun. This is not difficult to understand or appreciate, for the sun, the great source of life, was not known to them until he appeared at the time of the red light. In the second dimension, they were aware that the sun was but the face through which looked Taiwa, their creator. Always, they felt themselves to be in immediate and primary relationship with the universal entities out of which they had come. Their human parts were merely channels through which the creator created. The myth goes into minute detail concerning the revealing sacramental character of the dedicatory ceremony from the time of the birth of a child to that climactic moment when the mother is able to step forward, presenting her child to the rising sun with these words, "Father, son, this is your child." The Hopi's child's first 7 or 8 years are carefree and full of vital irresponsibility. Then, he must take an active part in the religious aspect of the common life. He must now learn that despite the fact of his having human parents, his true parents are the universal entities of which in some real sense his parents are but symbols, Mother Earth and Father Sun. All flesh comes from the former, and all life comes from the latter. Always he participates in the very essence of these two universals. He finds also that there are two dimensions within himself. He is a member of an earthly family and a clan, and he is, as well, a citizen of the universe. A more modern way of saying this is that he is both a space binder and a time binder. These first people sense the mystery of their own parenthood, as well as their own structure and nature. The myth seeks to interpret or account for the way in which the intent of the Creator could make itself manifest in the behavior of the first people. On various parts of the body were openings. At the top of the head was the open door, through which he received his life and connected with his Creator. During the last phase of creation, this soft spot was hardened. The door was closed, not to be opened until the time of death, when he departed from his body even as he had entered. The most exciting development in the accounts described the second center, the brain, just beneath the soft spot. It is with this organ, this part of himself, that he learned to think about himself, the world, and how he was to function in it. According to the myth, the real function of the thinking organ was to discover the intent, the plan of the Creator. The third center was the throat, through which he received the breath of life and through which he was able to give back his breath in sound. More and more, as he became acquainted with himself, he used this center to give praise to his Creator. The fourth center was the organ that pulsated with the vibration of life itself, the heart. Here was a center of feeling in which he experienced the good of life so long as he was of one heart. But when evil feelings entered, he became of two hearts. It is in this center that he sensed the purpose of life. Finally, there was the fifth center, the solar plexus, the throne in man that was occupied by the Creator and from whence he directed all the life of man. The first people were one in body and mind. Therefore, they did not know sickness. Sickness came only when the inner community of body and mind was disrupted by evil. The people were pure, innocent, and happy. The same quality obtains here as in the Garden of Eden. The people multiplied and grew, covering the face of the land. Despite the fact that they were of different colors and spoke different languages, they were one people and understood one another without speech or talking. The same was true of the birds and animals. Different forms there were, but there was one life, nourished by the Mother Earth and sired and sustained by the sun, through which the Creator worked or created. In time, the first people forgot the origin commanded to respect the Creator as the condition of the creation and continuity. More and more, they forsook his plan and intent that the people and the animals should all be one. Simultaneously with their estrangement from the plan of creation, there came among them the talker in the form of a bird called Motni. He kept talking among them, always making the same point that the people and the animals were fundamentally different, and that the same was true of the people whose color and languages varied. Accordingly, the differences were absolute and made a true distinction between peoples and between people and animals. Differences now became not merely apparent but dramatic. The animals began to draw away from man, and men began drawing away from one another. Fear, the great enemy of community, appeared. The final separation among the people was between those who remembered the plan and intent of the Creator and those who did not. It is unnecessary to follow the fate of the Hopis through all the experiences of new creations and fresh starts, including the final or fourth world. The common thread remains creation with the harmony of innocence, the loss of innocence, with a disintegration of the harmony. Waters' summary will suffice. Man is created perfect in the image of his Creator. Then, after closing the door, falling from grace into the uninhibited expression of his own human will, he begins his slow climb back upward. Within him are several psychological centers. At each successive stage of his evolution, one of these comes into dominant play. Also, for each stage, there is created a world body in the same order of development as his own body, for him to become manifest upon. When each successive period of development concludes with catastrophic destruction to the world and mankind, he passes on to the next. In the fourth stage of development, he reaches the lowest and midpoint of his journey. The fourth world, the present one, is the full expression of man's ruthless materialism and imperialistic will, and man himself reflects the gross appetites of the flesh. With this turn, man rises upward, bringing in to predominant function each of the higher centers. The door at the crown of the head then opens, and he merges into the wholeness of all creation, whence he sprang. It is a road of life he has traveled by his own free will, exhausting every capacity for good and evil, that he may know himself at last as a finite part of infinity. This creation myth repeats the primordial theme that dramatizes the ancient hunger of the spirit of man for a spiritual order that is never quite completely his, but is an integral part of a reality that nourishes in him the memory of a lost harmony, a memory latent in the soul and not distilled from the changing things of mere physical observation. In this way, the inner unity of the known and the knower may be preserved, and the almost mythic intuition of a reality thereby related to its conceptual and rational forms of expression. Here, as in Genesis, community, wholeness, is given to illustrate the intent of the Creator in creation. It is as if a model of community is provided that man might know the meaning of life. He has a potential that may be actualized in him as the fulfillment of the intent of the Creator. But it must be pointed out also that man has a potential for the rejection of the intent of the Creator. But the Creator is insistent that ultimately his intent will not be defeated. And this becomes at once the hope for both man and the Creator. The racial memory troubles man's sleep and grieves his waking hours, making him dream of peace even in the midst of war. In these two creation accounts, the starting point for man on earth is a situation that is orderly, whole, complete, integrated, a climate of community. This is a great racial assumption about the origin of man and the living context in which he is to grow, develop, and multiply. The experience of the race, however, at any moment in time, is an acute awareness of the absence of harmony. How can the cruel vicissitudes of disharmony, discord, disorder be tolerated without a sense of ultimate despair? There floats from the dim region of ancient memory the racial assurance that this condition is not normal, but the result of something other that has been set forth and established. Interestingly enough, there is no effort to attempt to explain the original fact of community, except that it is part of the givenness of the creative act. There was a time the experience of life was whole and continuity obtained through and in all of its manifestations. It was when life was fresh from the mind of the Creator, or from the womb of the earth, that it was untarnished and innocent. This was given by the Creator as the already actualized potential, as if the Creator wanted man to know what his true intent was in bringing life into being, and this experience of true intent was to serve as a constant tutor, reminding man in the midst of all of his divisions, chaos, disorder, and broken harmony, that he was made in and for harmony. Thus, man would never accept the absence of community as his destiny. When he asks, then, what life was like before there was pain, hate, bitterness, and violence, the word comes back that life was beautiful and whole, tranquil, and full of peace. Man has lost this dimension in his journey. He has sinned and missed the way. So these accounts remind us, but the echo, the sound of harmony, has not died in his dream. It lives in his myths, and what he hears in the echo is, at times, more real than the distortions through which he passes in his day-by-day endeavor. Again, the important clue to the Creator's intent is to be found in the racial memory of what life was like when life began. The experience of community as man's actualized potential must be distinguished from the experience of community as potential. The experience of community as instant fact in the experience of innocence. These myths show clearly that the potential for disharmony also resides in man. Mark, you, both good and evil, are potential. But the accounts take pains to explain that the sample that man is permitted to experience as explicit in his creation is community, the good. The potential for disharmony is triggered by his exercise of choice by volition, in which he commits himself to the choice. Once this is done, he is no longer innocent. Once man has embarked upon his journey, these two potentials exist in him as parallel lines that cannot merge. It is not until he achieves goodness that they may blend into creative synthesis. Man's original experience of community is both potential and actualized potential within the framework of innocence. During this period, the things that work against community are dormant. The experience of community based upon innocence obtains so long as elements of disharmony are not apparent. There is present the freedom and abandonment of innocence, and yet the freedom is not absolute. Freedom has meaning only with reference to limitations in some form. The fact that Adam and Eve were not permitted to eat the fruit of the tree of knowledge gave meaning to the experience of freedom. They also lacked responsibility in all aspects of their life, except with reference to eating the forbidden fruit. Where there is prohibition, there is cost or penalty. Hence, responsibility is inevitable. Responsibility operates at two levels where actions are concerned. There is a responsibility that flows automatically from the act itself, which sets in motion elements that are dormant prior to the act. By his act, the individual precipitates a chain reaction before which he may be helpless, and by which he is carried on to the conclusion of the logic of the act itself. In the story of the Garden of Eden, Adam's act was of that kind, as were the acts of the first people in the first world of the Hopi. The whole series of events followed in both instances throughout the world of nature and beyond, which were not viable until the crucial act or acts were performed. In this sense, the responsibility for the act is impersonal. Secondly, there is also a profound element of personal responsibility here. This is shown initially by Adam. He feels guilty. He realizes that he is naked. He is ashamed. Something in him is broken down and he no longer is at peace. He accuses the woman. He hides from God. And his whole world is thrown out of harmony. He is faced with the responsibility for his action. But it does not stop there. The story continues. Then the Lord God said to the woman, "What have you done?" The woman said, "It was the serpent that misled me, so I ate it." So the Lord God said to the serpent, "Because you have done this, the most cursed of all animals shall you be, and of all the wild beasts. On your belly you shall crawl and eat dust as long as you live. I will put enmity between you and the world and between your posterity and hers. They shall attack you in the head and you shall attack them in the heel." To the woman he said, "I will make your pain at childbirth very great. In pain shall you bear children, and yet you shall be devoted to your husband, while he shall rule over you." And to the man he said, "Because you followed your wife's suggestions and ate from the tree from which I commanded you not to eat, cursed shall be the ground through you. In suffering shall you gain your living from it as long as you live. Thorns and thistles shall it produce for you, so that you will have to eat wild plants. By the sweat of your brow shall you earn your living until you return to the ground, since it was from it that you were taken, for dust you are, and to dust you must return." When through a responsible act on his part, an act of deliberate choice, that which is dormant and therefore potential becomes active or becomes actualized potential, then the two parallel lines merge in him. A sense of guilt becomes his portion. This guilt has to be purged before he can triumph in goodness. What is meant here can be best understood by examining the difference between goodness and innocence. That which is innocent is essentially untried, untested, unchallenged. It is complete and whole in itself because it has known nothing else. When innocence is lost because of violation, however defined, something in the individual begins working to recover a lost grace. When the quality of goodness has been reestablished, a great change has taken place. Eyes are open, knowledge is defined, and what results in the triumph of the quality of innocence over the quality of discord? A new synthesis is achieved that has in it the element of triumph. That is, a child is innocent, but a man who has learned how to winnow beauty out of ugliness, purity out of sin, tranquility out of tempest, joy out of sorrow, life out of death, only such a man may be said to be good, but he is no longer innocent. Man was put out of the Garden of Eden with his innocence lost, his sense of community within himself and with all of life corrupted. The victim of guilt and struggle, with all of the tempests that revolve around the head of the tortured spirit, the judgment is very solemn. Therefore, the Lord God sent him from the Garden of Eden to till the ground from whence he was taken. So he drove out the man, and he placed at the east of the Garden of Eden cherubim and a flaming sword which turned every way to keep the way of the tree of life. In like manner, the first people of the Hopi myth were sent forth on the road of life to wander and struggle and suffer until they came to their own place, until they came home to themselves, until they became whole. The story of a man's struggle on the planet haunting him as he builds his cultures, his civilizations, as he erects his altars and makes his sacrifices before his God, is to find his way back to the Garden of Eden, which must yet be achieved. To achieve community in the midst of all the things he brought upon himself by his own deeds, things that work most against community, is to sweep past the angel with the flaming sword and build a new home in the Garden of Eden. At man's moment of greatest despair, he is instinctively unwilling and perhaps unable to accept the contradictions of his life as final or ultimate. Something deep within reminds him that the intent of the Creator of life and the living substance is that men must live in harmony within themselves and with one another, and perhaps with all of life. When he seeks to achieve it, even in his little world of belonging and meaning, what is at first the dim racial memory stirring deep within him becomes the paean of a great transcendent chorus rejoicing him on his way. It may be that man's experience of himself as a child of nature and the long journey of his organism to self-consciousness and reflective thought may yield another clue to what seems to be the ground of community in the integrity of life itself.